Hello and welcome to Psychology in Seattle. I'm your host, Kirk Honda, professor and licensed therapist. Today, I have a special guest on the show today, Monica. She's a listener, and she emailed me a few months ago, and we chatted over email, and I invited her on the show to ask the questions that she was asking over email so that the listeners might benefit from the questions and the answers. And I also think she might have some things to offer the listeners as well, because she has some interesting experiences in some fields that might be interesting to you. So welcome to the show, Monica.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Good. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a homeschooled teen in Chicago, and I grew up in a family that uses NVC, or nonviolent communication, through my mom mainly, who started the whole process and wanted to create an environment in our home that was very safe and open and expressive. And she pretty much taught us by example. She didn't force anything into our pool of tools to use for expression. And about 7 years ago, we came here to Seattle to participate in a family camp where we could do trainings and workshops for both parents and adults. And that was a very enriching environment, community that we experienced there. And we've just come back every single year since then.
So your mom had heard about or been exposed to nonviolent communication,
yeah.
And had been using that in your home in mm-hmm. her communication with you and teaching you how to communicate mm-hmm. in a nonviolent way.
Yeah.
And then you started coming out to Seattle or Vashon Island, which is near Seattle. Is Vashon Island a part of Seattle?
You know, I'm not sure if it's considered Seattle.
It might be, actually. But anyway, it's very different from Seattle. It's very rural feeling.
Yes.
And you're either an islander or you're a non-islander.
Yeah.
And they have a camp there, apparently, where some people teach nonviolent communication mm-hmm. to children and parents. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people find it beneficial, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And you're here in Seattle to do that this summer as you have in previous summers.
Yes.
How's that going so far?
It's good. It starts on Saturday.
Okay. And, are you getting all your violent communication out of the way?
Not really. You know, nonviolent is kind of, I don't know, it has a negative pull for me too. So I refer to compassionate communication a lot lately because nonviolent, those are both negatives before the positive communication. So I've started saying compassionate communication. Like an example would be, I feel really upset because you're making me do this, where that's invoking a lot of blame and judgment, and the street becomes one way and that creates a conflict. Mm-hmm. So compassionate communication is a lot of just one-sided expression and allowing the other person to hear that and react and share how that affects them. So it's a lot of connecting with your feelings, whether you're feeling sad or disappointed, disheartened, discouraged, distant. You know, those are very kind of cool, negative feelings.
So instead of saying, like, I hate you, Mom, because you're making me do homework when I'd rather be playing video games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think in that kind of a situation, the homework doer might feel discouraged or, you know, unenthusiastic, uninspired to do homework. So having some space or just, you know, a safe space to reconnect with that inspiration, having that be heard too.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I have a little sister, yeah.
Does she communicate as well as you do?
Probably better.
Okay.
she's grown up, you know, within it, and I had about 9 years beforehand where I didn't have that feelings and needs vocabulary. She's fantastic at it.
Well, that's great. I sometimes wonder if our society and culture and our parenting practices involved more things along these lines, what would happen? Mm-hmm. And it seems like in your case with you and your sister, it has a really positive effect. I mean, am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. We're 6.5 years apart, so we've had our differences in age. Sometimes that creates conflict between us because we're at such different stages in our lives that we're going through very different things. And being able to connect with my feelings and what I'm needing And expressing that to her is super helpful, because there are a lot of times where she does want to connect with me and be in my space. And there are times where I feel more distant and like enwrapped in work and things like that. It's very sweet too. It's very tender to be able to hear that she is wanting connection, and she's wanting, you know, someone just to be there for her other than like my mom. And it's really kind of sweet and special for her to come to me with that, you know, to say, hey, you're the person I kind of look up to, and I want you to be really a staple in my life, and I want us to talk. And she's well beyond her years too. She's 11 and already way past where I was at that point.
Interesting. Yeah. So instead of saying, let's play a game, or bothering you to engage with you.
Yeah. You never play with me.
Right. And then you saying, get out of my room, you're always bothering me. And then she runs away crying. Yeah. And says, you know,
that happens very rarely.
Monica's mean. And your mom says, you know, stop being mean to your, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like a very common dynamic in families. Instead of that, she comes to you and says something like, I really like connecting with you because you're my older sister and I miss us connecting, or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that can inspire you to actually respond in a way that she wants and might be gratifying to you, rather than little sister coming in and messing with your stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really common, you know, like younger siblings, as a way of trying to connect, will often, when they can't get what they want, they'll often just start bothering their older siblings just because they want some interaction. You know, they're being ignored. So one way to not be ignored is to bother the older sibling, and then, mm-hmm. then you're in a fight, right?
Right,
so
yeah.
It sounds like your sister's benefited from learning the skills and philosophies around compassionate communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Yeah.
So what questions do you have for me?
Okay, so I wrote these all up on the bus while I was here. I had them all on my phone. Because I'm really interested in going into becoming, like, taking training and getting educated in the whole therapy world, these were a couple of questions that came up. For you as a therapist, like, what drew you to that line of work?
People ask me that sometimes, and it's a tough question to answer, because it has to do with inspiration and the meaning of life to me. But essentially, it brought together a lot of different interests into a job. I've always been really interested in talking to people. I've always been interested in thinking about things. I've always been interested in how people work. And I've always been interested in wanting to help society in whatever way I can. And so the field of psychotherapy and psychology really brings all those things together. Mm-hmm. So I literally get paid to think sometimes. And that's great. I mean, how many jobs are like that, you know?
Yeah.
I get paid to talk to people, which is also great. So, you know, in a nutshell, that's what drew me to the profession.
Hmm. Cool. All right. And then what was the training process like? I mean, you went to Antioch, right, here mm-hmm. in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who goes to Antioch in Ohio.
Okay.
I understand it's a different kind of learning environment, and I'm curious as to what that whole process was like. Was it challenging for you? Was it, you know, in a positive way or a negative way? How was it for you?
Yeah. Well, after high school, I went to the University of Washington and received a business degree, because I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point in my life, and I didn't want to get a degree in comparative literature. So I decided to get something applicable that I thought might be used.
Mm-hmm.
And I did use it, but then, you know, at the age of 24, I decided to become a therapist. And I went to Antioch in the mid-90s and got my master's in psychology to practice as a therapist. And it was challenging for me, because I had grown up in the standard schooling environment, and the University of Washington is certainly very old school in terms of the way they teach large lecture. I mean, my psychology 101 course, for instance, had 1,000 people in it. So, you know, it's very lecture-based, test-based. I don't know if I ever talked to one of my professors. I think in the business school, I might have talked to one or two, but it wasn't that kind of situation, I guess. There wasn't a lot of discussion. I certainly didn't write very much. A lot of tests. So mm-hmm. I go to Antioch, and the classes are like, you know, 10 people, and I'm way the youngest person in class. Most people are in, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. And lots of discussion, and the teacher sits down with us and talks to us. And it was just completely foreign to me and felt chaotic. And I felt like my personality was to some extent being evaluated, you know. The markers of success in a psychology program typically are very ambiguous. Mm-hmm. In the business school I went to, if you passed the test and you got 92%, you got an A. I mean, that, and it didn't matter what your personality was. When I took accounting, it didn't matter how I felt about anything. Mm-hmm. At Antioch,
that was very clear and
concrete.
Yeah, concrete.
But at Antioch, everything had to do with how I felt about things, and everything had to do about my personal growth as a human being. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was writing, and of course, there was learning theory, and there even was some tests. But it was so all encompassing, and so it was pretty anxiety provoking for me, actually, when I was in my 20s. I subsequently, years later, went back for my doctorate, and being older and having been in the field and having done a lot of personal work and just feeling older and more confident, in my doctorate, I felt much more relaxed, and it was a much more enjoyable process. My master's was enjoyable, but my doctorate was really enjoyable, I guess I should say. Antioch sometimes gets this reputation for being really, really new agey and really, you know, floppy and and purple and frilly and unironed. I'm using lots of metaphors. And I just described a lot of that in my description. But as a professor at Antioch, I can tell you that that's half of the experience. The other half is just straight up learning. I, for instance, quiz my students. I want to make sure that they graduate having known a pretty good number of things that they need to know. And so it is skill-based. It is evidence-based in terms of the sort of things that we teach. So we really, at Antioch, as a professor, I can say we have one foot in the floppy, unironed, purple world and one foot firmly in the concrete, academic world as well.
So it's very balanced.
We try to strike a balance, because I think that that's the best model to produce competent therapists. They have to feel safe, and they have to grow personally.
Yeah, well-rounded. It sounds like you need to be really solid.
And you have to learn concrete things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not going to be a competent professional.
Yeah, absolutely. So which environment did you enjoy more?
The UW or the floppy world?
Yeah.
The floppy world I enjoy so much more. I mean, UW was a long time ago, so it's hard for me to remember precisely what it was like. I mean, I guess I barely remember school. I remember more of the social life in college than the school, whereas my master's and my doctorate, I remember a lot of moments in school, very memorable moments. So at UW, I remember sitting in class and just being bored out of my mind. Although actually my last couple quarters, I had saved up all of my electives to take whatever I wanted, so I didn't have to take anything required. And I took all music courses. So I took a composition course where it was me and four or five other students writing music and comparing our music. And the professor would tear us apart, particularly me, because I was the only non-classical writer, and and there was one jazz. At UW, they're so old school. If you're jazz, they look down on jazz because jazz is like the new kid in town. So I'm coming in with my folk songs and my rock songs, and they're really looking down on me. The other students liked it, but the professor was just like, this is ridiculous.
Oh, my goodness.
And I took a bunch of other courses like computer music theory and all these other courses. And I just loved it. How did I get on this topic? Mm-hmm. So I remember that. I remember those courses, you know?
Yeah.
But the business courses and the other courses I don't remember so well. But so, yeah, I highly recommend if you go into the field of psychology and counseling that you pick a somewhat floppy school.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's where I'm headed, I hope. Would you have done anything differently? Would you have wished that your professors were teaching along a different line? Or is there anything that you didn't enjoy that you still wish, like today, that's just kind of sour?
In school?
Yeah, through your education and through your training to become a therapist.
Well, I didn't do much research regarding where to go to school. I'm really glad I went to Antioch, but what if Antioch was terrible? So I would have just persevered, you know? I would have just pushed through. I feel like for the average person, and I think I'm average in this way, the information is hard to get for whatever reason. You know, if you want to buy a car, there's car lots, you just drive down the street.
It's endless, right? Yeah. There's so much to choose from.
Yeah. You could type in, I want to buy a car, and there'll be hundreds of guides. And but like, if I want to be, I want a career in psychology, it's really hard for the average person to figure out what to do. And so I think a lot of people end up falling into a graduate program. So this isn't really a regret on my end. I guess I'm just bringing up something that people should hear. Because some people end up coming to Antioch having been at another graduate program and hated it for one reason or another. They liked it too in some ways, but they also disliked it for some reasons. And then they come to Antioch and they say they wish they would have done more shopping and more asking around. But they shouldn't have to do that actively. That information should be readily available, but for whatever reason it isn't. But what's something that I regret? In my master's program, I regret being so anxious. You know, I was 25, 24, and I was too much in my head and didn't let go.
So that must have taken some of your focus away from the education process.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's something that I spend a good amount of time with my students, is to lower their anxiety. I frequently tell them, if you're anxious, that's my fault as a professor. That if you're anxious, tell me and I'll do whatever I need to do to make you not anxious, because you don't have anything to worry about. There's nothing you can do within the normal range of impulses that would ruin your experience as a student. Yeah. You're not going to accidentally reveal that you're a terrible person. That's just, you know, you're going to reveal you're a normal human being with a range of impulses and thoughts and feelings, which is normal, and that's okay. So I regret not allowing myself to be myself. I mean, I was sometimes, but overall, I was really, in my master's program, I was really just trying to hold on. I mean, just as a for instance, in my first quarter of my master's, again, I'm 24 years old, and I come from this business school, and I've never been close to a therapist. I don't know any therapists. I don't come from that world. The first quarter, we talked about empathy. I'd never heard of it before. I mean, I might have heard the word, but the concept was completely foreign to me. So, and I remember everyone else in our, you know, our five-person class or six- or seven-person class, they knew I mean, they all knew what empathy was, like it was just in the water that they grew up in or something. And I'm like, what's empathy? So that's how lost I was. And so right from the start, I realized, man, I am lost. and part of me, you know, and I should have said, you know what, I'm lost. You guys have a lot more experience than I do. You're 40 years old. You've been thinking about becoming a therapist for 20 of those years. I just decided, you know, probably like 6 months prior. So, you know, and I should have just admitted it, but instead I went underground and tried to hide because I felt like it shouldn't be seen. But now as a professor, looking back at that, I think that's ridiculous.
Well, maybe in the heat of the moment, being in a professional, you know, going into a professional world, that might have been really kind of scary to admit, too, that you're like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
So,
but you're a student. That's,
yeah.
I mean, that's what
that's
I tell students. There's this weird expectation that students feel like they're supposed to know everything prior to learning it. It's really weird. I mean, they get into the master's or the doctoral program, and they feel bad for not knowing something. Huh. That, how does that make any sense? You're in school.
Yeah.
By definition, you don't know things. Revel in that. Revel in the fact you don't know.
Yeah.
And require me to teach you that.
Yeah.
If you knew everything prior to coming in, then you wouldn't be here. And so it's this weird thing that I think it's also that by the time you get into master's and doctoral programs, these are the individuals that have been doing very well in school throughout their entire lives. Mm-hmm. Throughout their entire life. And so I think they've just always, they're used to being the top of the class. They're used to knowing
sure.
everything.
Yeah.
And then they get lumped in with a bunch of other people like that. And they suddenly, for the first time in their life, feel average.
Mm.
And that isn't comfortable to them.
And one question I had for you later, too, was like, how do you address that in a social setting when you say I'm a therapist? Just do people react differently to you? I'm sure they do. Like, oh, he's secretly evaluating me or something.
At parties, I sometimes say I work at Microsoft because no one wants to know anything about my job.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes I say that because of what you're saying.
Yeah, to avoid that, like,
yeah.
distancing.
Yeah. Or the some people judge too. They'll
sure.
they'll say, "Oh, you're one of those people," or I mean, my main job is I'm a professor, so if I say that, they say, oh, those who can't do teach, right? They'll say stuff like that. They'll say stuff like that, or they'll think some things that are in my head that might not be, or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, people think, oh, do you analyze people all the time? Are you analyzing me?
Hmm.
I think it's changed, though, over my 18 years. Yeah, I think in the 90s and, you know, back toward the 90s, people were more likely to have those negative reactions to me when I said what I did. But I think more lately people are more, they have a better understanding of what I do,
mm-hmm.
that I'm not analyzing everybody all the time.
Yeah.
And that I'm not to be feared, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So my next question, which was to contradict that, what's most challenging is what's most rewarding.
Yeah.
That comes, what comes out of a session that just feels like you're on the top of the moon?
Yeah, there's so many things. I mean, in general, it's when things are going well. But one kind of situation specific to that would be, I do a lot of couples work and family work.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing when a client says to me, I really like working with you. You know, I really like talking with you. And that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another thing when, and I might cry just thinking about it, but when two people who desperately want to connect and have been not connecting and have been hurt by each other and have been angry at each other and have been having their relationship get to the point where they don't even want to be with each other anymore, to be witness to that doing a 180 and now they're open to each other and they love each other and they might even hug in session and you just feel that energy, you know, and they see each other and they understand each other, you know, along the lines of compassionate communication, you know, they're utilizing that kind of voice. To see that change and to see how happy they are and to see that now we're heading in another direction and I don't even have to do anything, you know, and they're just doing it in the session, and to be witness to that is very gratifying.
Do you ever encounter clients that might come to you with a very unique issue that maybe you're not educated in, that maybe isn't, you know, the knowledge around what they're going through isn't available or something? I'm guessing depression is a very general condition that people have,
yeah.
but something that might be very rare, or
I see.
Maybe they don't even know that they are going through something difficult, or, and you know, you're trying to figure out like, what is this person going through? And maybe you're asking your general questions and nothing is like fitting into these boxes.
Yeah.
And they're kind of just floating around and you don't know how to treat them. What do you do?
I feel that way a majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think I realized this early on that it's hard to put people into boxes, even though some people want to, I suppose.
We try, yeah.
Yeah. So pretty much every client I work with, it's like that. But I like that. Yeah. I like that it's a mystery and it's squishy and mm-hmm. each person is unique and each condition is unique. Each expression of depression is unique.
Yeah.
So I like that, yeah. But it can be hard sometimes because as I learn things and gain more experience, I look back on things I was doing even 5 years ago and think, I didn't know what I was doing there. there are things, you know, at the time I had, say, 10 years of experience or some 12 years of experience. I thought I had, you know, basically seen the main categories mm-hmm. and basically knew at least where to look if I needed to know something. Mm-hmm. And now I look back and I think I was a little overconfident, which makes you wonder, in another 5 years, am I going to look back at me now and think, boy, you really didn't know what you were doing. Mm. It's a vast field and people are infinitely complex.
Yeah,
I'm continually baffled by things.
That's something that actually really attracts me to interacting with other human beings is, yeah, we're all completely unique and, you know, none of our wires are never the same. And it's just a blank canvas that we kind of draw on together. And that's so interesting because you never get bored, I'm guessing. You know, it's just mm-hmm. always new and interesting. And as people, we grow mm-hmm. so much that there's never a dull moment.
Yeah, there isn't. I can imagine if you worked with one particular population, with one particular issue, it mm-hmm. might get a little mundane, but yeah, I'm never bored with my clients and I've been doing this work for a long time, you know?
Yeah.
I thought I would have only lasted, when I first started, I said, well, I'll do it for 10 years and then I'll do something else. Because I'm sure after 10 years, I'll be bored out of my mind. but I wasn't. Yeah. And I remember as the 10-year mark approached, I said, I don't think I'm bored of this yet. And actually, I had whole areas that I had yet to even know about to look into.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually one of the things about doing podcasting that is interesting too, in that, you know, for instance, this compassionate communication field is something I haven't heard about before. So it's like, oh, maybe I should look into that, you know? It's like, and this model of how to get families to be inspired to do it by going to a camp that's all about compassionate communication. But let me ask you a couple questions that just occurred to me. You mentioned that you're homeschooled,
mm-hmm.
and you were homeschooled from when to when? Your whole life?
My whole life, yeah. I've never gone to a traditional school at all.
Yeah. And do you live in a small town, big town?
No, we're in Chicago, and we're in the north side of Chicago. We're not in downtown. But we're in the city.
And I've been in Chicago, and I remember someone saying that, is it the south side or the north side that's sort of sketchy?
That's the south side, yeah. That is more...
gangs and...
Yeah, yeah. So there is kind of a negative association around the south side usually in Chicago. And I mean, I don't mind the south side. I feel comfortable. But it's when it gets dark, I think, that people, you know, start to... gets suspicious too, and just it doesn't feel safe anymore.
Huh.
But where we are, we're north, we're about 2 miles north of downtown, and the community that we're in is actually I haven't seen it very in many places other than where we are, because it's a very tight-knit community of neighbors. We're right by the river, and this gentleman has kind of created this wonderfully sweet connected community called the Riverbank Neighbors, and we get together for solstices, and you know, so it's been a very enriching, motivating, supportive community to grow up in the city.
Are there other homeschool kids in your neighborhood?
In Chicago there is. In our neighborhood, yeah, there have been families that have moved in fairly close to where we are. But in Illinois, the laws around homeschooling are looser.
Huh.
So every home that homeschools is considered a private school.
Huh.
We don't have to submit tests every year or anything like that. It's put on the parents to teach the children in a way that they feel they're getting everything that they need. And we have a couple homeschooling communities in which other teachers and parents will offer classes. And recently, students, too, will, you know, teach classes and because we're all students and we're all teachers, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll get together in a, you know, a building and offer classes, all kinds of classes, math, yoga, you know, it goes the whole spectrum. So yeah, there are things like that. There's a lot of acting. I've done a lot of acting in my middle school and high school years.
Really? So you're involved with other people in the homeschool community.
Yeah, it's very connected.
Oh, I see. So it's not just isolated in your home.
Not at all, no.
So there'll be like co-ops or something where the older kids might teach a math class to the younger kids. Because in my head, I think homeschool, you don't interact with other homeschool kids.
And I think that's how it started was, you know, one thing people think about when they think homeschooling is religious families. Religious families would keep their children and teach their children in their home so that they knew exactly what they were learning and knew exactly what was going into their lives. And I think that's kind of where it started. But then people started to see the value in teaching your children at home and having a strong connection with their education and their learning. And learning for me has always been enjoyable and it's always been fun because I've had the freedom to create my own curriculum and follow what interests me. And I can excel in certain fields and hold back in certain fields that I don't feel super inspired in. Mm-hmm. So I'm really like on my own track and I can like customize what I'm learning. And so learning in school doesn't start and stop for me. Like there aren't hours in which I, you know, do my homework and everything like that. And so like summer break, people have been asking me about graduation and technically I'm, you know, I've graduated this year and I'm doing a gap year, but I'm still learning. It's like school hasn't stopped for me. Mm. It's kind of just, I take it wherever I go.
Yeah, it's a better philosophy to have about learning, right? It's like, oh, well, I'm not in school, so I'm not learning anymore. So you're open to learning all the time. Mm-hmm. So your mom's in charge of your school?
Cooperatively, yeah. So we work together and we've worked with other parents and other teachers. And I've learned a lot from my dad in the field of like construction. My dad's a carpenter and he has his own business. So I had my own tool belt and toolbox, you know, as soon as I could carry one and hold one. So,
well, he must have liked that.
I think so.
Well, your parents must be very mature, nice people because it's hard, I think, for some parents to manage the emotions that go into the frustration when teaching children and trying to corral them. You know, one of the nice things about the public school system or even the private school system is that the parents don't have to deal with their kids for a set amount of time. So your parents must be pretty patient people, is just a guess.
I would say so. Okay. It's been my experience with them. I'm super grateful for that for sure.
Yeah.
And it's not for everyone. Homeschooling really isn't for everybody. And
yeah,
the selective few that do have that motivation to have a school and a learning environment in their home and have the energy for that and also know when to say, hey, I need some personal time. I need some personal space. And that's where NVC has become really handy in our family is when my mom is just overwhelmed and overworked and she can express that to us and we don't feel like neglected or, you know, like, oh, she's not spending time with us. What are we doing wrong?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just her needing her own time and her own space. And so that's been very helpful.
So who do you think is not a good candidate for homeschooling? What sort of person?
Well, I think if you have a career in which, as a parent, you have a career outside the home, you know, you're working in an office or you're traveling or something, and it's difficult to spend time at home, then having that environment where you know your child is being cared for and taught and fed like a public school or private school, that can be really reassuring to you as the parent. If you have two working parents or if you're a single parent, it can be a lot of stress, I'm sure.
Right. Does your mom work?
No, she's a stay-at-home mom.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I guess it didn't occur to me. I guess if you had two working parents in offices in the city, it would be
especially
impossible.
Having young kids too. Yeah, they can't be at home alone and a nanny is, you know, extra work and making sure that they're being taught what you want them to learn. I think it's just simpler and creates more ease in your life as a parent to have your child in a a community with friends and supporters and teachers, and, you know, they're interacting.
Evolutionarily, when we were tribal back in the day, we did not have massive schools, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't even have schools, right?
Right.
Children learned from their parents, and they learned from their neighbors. They were with their parents and their neighbors and their siblings. Whereas today's system, how often do siblings even see each other? How often do children see their parents Monday through Friday?
Yeah.
And they're in an environment that's very foreign to our history, in that they're in a school with 1,500 people that, and of the vast majority of them, they don't know, or at least they don't know well. And you can imagine that might create anxiety and some of the difficulties that we see in teenage life. Whereas if you're at home and you're bonded with your parents and you feel loved and cared for, and you respect your parents maybe in a different way, that seemingly would lead to better adjustment. And I mean, you certainly seem extremely mature and well-spoken and balanced. So you're well cooked, you know, your mom left you in the oven for the allotted amount of time. And so it makes me wonder if we should all be homeschooling instead. But I wonder what are the downsides to being homeschooled?
Mm. Yeah, I've thought of that too. Like, you know, I think there are benefits in both areas, both homeschooling, unschooling, and being in a public school or private school.
Did you say unschooling?
Unschooling,
what's
yeah.
unschooling?
It's not having fixed times in which you learn. So homeschooling is much more textbook oriented. It's like having a classroom,
right.
a school classroom.
Yeah, there's like workbooks and there's
quizzes
along the way.
Yeah. So we've done both, but especially in my younger years, we were unschooling, and we would learn through play, very Waldorf-like schooling. Hmm. So I guess the downsides are, I guess, well, there have been points in my schooling, you know, education where I do wish like I had the resources that a school would have, like a lab or, you know, something like that, where the resources and materials are readily available, and to have a professor that is very educated in that subject. Whereas sometimes my mom and I will be learning together, you know, she doesn't know every single subject, you know, front to back. So
totally.
Yeah, I guess there have been times where like I've been so interested in something that I want to go farther, you know, into that world, like biology. That's hard to bring home. Mm. But we've made do, you know, and there are other resources. There are other families.
Well, I'm guessing with the internet now,
yeah.
with YouTube, if you wanted to learn. I mean, I personally would love to be a kid in today's world. The access to information, you know, if you just wanted to learn like about biology or something. I mean, I just saw a video yesterday about the immune system. It was like this really well-made video,
sure.
like a professional, very professional sort of deal.
Yeah.
And after 6 minutes, it totally blew my mind. The immune system is bizarre and complex. And but I feel like I understand it way better now. So I'm sure you supplement in that way. So you're saying that's a downside. But, you know, one of the main downsides that people identify is the social aspects, right? Because high school is very social, naturally.
Sure.
The football games and the proms and the
the
in-between class times and the rallies and that sort of thing. Is that a downside to being homeschooled?
I don't think so. Not for me. And I've been very lucky in my community and living in the city, too. There are a lot of other families doing what we're doing. And a lot of families that have the same philosophy. So we did a homeschool Girl Scout troop when I was starting at like 7 to 12 or something like that. And so I had this very close-knit group of friends that I grew up with and I'm still friends with. And I think my experience has been I've met a lot of very mature young people through homeschooling who are very solid in their beliefs and are also comfortable like saying, I don't know that, you know, can you teach it to me when asked a question instead of feeling pressured and tested?
Yeah, it's interesting because I just think about the way that high schoolers are typically.
Sure, the stereotype.
Yeah, the stereotype.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly, I you know, counsel a lot of teenagers. So, yeah. You know, they run the gamut. But there's, you know, there's this general stance of a high schooler where it's like, oh, I got to go to school and got to deal with the teacher. And sure. Like, oh, they gave me this assignment. I got to get this assignment done. And, oh, my God, homework. And, you know, like it doesn't seem pleasurable.
Sure. Yeah. Like they're not benefiting from that.
Yeah. And it seems like the model might produce that because you have teachers that don't listen to the student in terms of what do you want, right? This is the curriculum. Sit down and shut up and do your work. I mean, there are wonderful teachers, but that's the model that they follow. And they're forced to do that model by the system. I mean, if a teacher wants to go off the grid, they will quickly be put back on the grid.
Right.
And then I just think about the anxiety that's produced by being exposed to all these people and trying to fit in with everybody. And then the worries of people talking about you. And I'm guessing when you're in a smaller, tight-knit community, you have the opportunity to really build relationships with people and trust with people in a way that you could never do with 1,000 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that's been part of it. It's a small community, but it's a very established community, and some staples in my like social life, we could say, have been, you know, Girl Scouts starting from a young age. That was so fun. And I think we were more like Boy Scouts. We did a lot of camping together and, you know, a lot of adventures. And we went to Niagara Falls and that was super fun. So, you know, we go through a lot together and we get so close so fast because there was me and 4 other girls. We were called the Fab Five. And, you know, I'm still very close with a couple of them today. And then theater was just a huge staple in my life as well. We would become family, you know, creating this story together. And we were all homeschoolers and around the same age. And actually last year, one of my very first directors asked me to go on a road trip with her and her 4 kids and be their on-road nanny. And so we came through Seattle and we stayed around here, actually. So, you know, those connections that are made, they're solid. And but our communities, our homeschooling communities, we do things like dances and classes and we'll get together and
you'll have dances?
Yeah. There have been, you know, some really fun moms who decide we should have a dance and we'll get together. And it's not a crazy kind of dance. It's, you know, it's just a whole bunch of friends kind of goofing off and playing. And
How many kids?
Oh, at a dance like that, I think about 25 or 30 would show up. Yeah, it fluctuates.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I know everyone there. I know every single person and I feel comfortable with everybody there. And so that's been really wonderful. I'm not a crowd person either. So I really enjoy like intimate connections, like really strong connections.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's worked for me in that aspect.
I mean, I know some kids who have been homeschooled, and I can tell you that your homeschool community is very different from the ones that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like the people that you guys are involved with have a system that is pretty robust.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of kids who get homeschooled, they don't have an organization like that among the parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to hear you talk about it, because if you just talked about your life, you know, it's like it's a little bit Laura Ingalls on the Prairie. It's a little bit like futuristic, you know, but it definitely doesn't. I wouldn't think Chicago, do you know what I mean?
Sure.
A massive city with millions of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also don't think of Chicago as being particularly progressive, but maybe it is. Yeah. So that's another, like that would be like, what city is this from? They'd say like San Francisco or something, or Berkeley, not, you know, Chicago. So it's great to hear. I wonder if things are headed in that direction. And so I feel like things are not headed in that direction, though. But I feel like they should be. At the very least, I would like it if schools were smaller. I'm actually a small public school nearby hires me to do work for them. And a lot of the kids act kind of the way you do in the direction that you are because of the smaller community. And it, the plus also the school 6 through 12. So you are with the same teachers and the same people throughout mm-hmm. that time. And so I just think the model of 2,000 kids in a school is just not conducive to personal development.
I would think it's too overwhelming to actually be able to focus on individual connections.
Right. People are about people.
Yeah.
And we're not, you know, numbers. And when we get treated like that, then, you know, you have an increase in bad things happening. And there's a lot of bad things happening in high school right now. Mm. Well, kudos to your mom and your dad and all the people in your community who has created and raised a good person. So,
oh, thanks. Okay, I have two key questions. I'll go with this one first. What do you do when you've established a connection with your client and you find out that they're unable to afford the cost of therapy? What does that do to the relationship?
That they can't afford it?
Yeah. And maybe you feel like you just really want to help, but professionally it's not to your advantage.
Right.
What do you do?
Right. Because it's a job. We have to earn a living.
Yeah.
Well, there's two things. One is sometimes, unfortunately, the relationship has to end and we have to refer them somewhere that can accommodate them, because there are mm-hmm. places that can accommodate people that don't have insurance or the money to pay for mental health therapy. But therapists ethically are supposed to do some advocacy, which might involve some pro bono services. So any therapist who cares about the community will take on some free, mm-hmm. some clients who don't pay for therapy, or at least reduce the fee quite a bit. Therapists are very nice, bleeding heart people. Mm-hmm. So it's not hard to convince them to do pro bono work.
Sure. Yeah, of course. All right. And probably the one that like has boiled in me the most is when you have a client or even a close friend that you see is struggling and what you're doing doesn't seem to be moving them along enough, and you know, you're not seeing the benefit very quickly, and maybe they're just a very giving person and it's difficult to plug that back in and like care for themselves and be able to take care of themselves. I mean, how do you address that kind of thing? It's happened with me, like personally with friends and stuff.
So you have a friend who isn't taking care of themselves and you're worried about them and you wonder what you could do to maybe help them take care of themselves.
Yeah. And this person specifically, I won't name names, but is very, very able to give and very able to help other people.
Yeah.
And they're just stuck in their own like self-care program. So trying to reassure them and say, hey, you matter too. You need to take care of yourself. You need some self time, and wanting them to be inspired and motivated to do that and then not seeing it happen. I feel discouraged. I feel kind of sad and also like helpless. Like, oh my gosh, what can I do? Because I know this is your thing and I know this is what you need to figure out for yourself. Yeah. And it's like an inner struggle within me. Like, I know I can't just shake you and make the parts fit together again. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. What do you do?
Yeah. I mean, you've basically answered the question. You know, you recognize the feelings and you accept them, that you are helpless, that it is sad and it is frustrating. You know, it's a tough question to answer because I don't know the person you're talking about. But in general, the first step is just accept that you might not be able to do anything about it. The other thing is if you are going to do something about it, it's probably going to take time. And the best thing you can do for that person is be a good friend and just be there for them when they're suffering. But some other things you can do is model. So you can, when you have a similar thing, you deal with it in one way and then show them how you like to do it, and maybe they can benefit from that. Another one is just to tell them what is on your mind. Mm-hmm. Just be like, you know what, I'm really scared for you. I feel bad for you sometimes because I feel like you deserve to be taken care of, and you're not doing that for yourself for whatever reason. But often when people do that, it doesn't usually change things. You know, I work with people for years on just that issue, and they really want to change. So we have to lower our expectations in terms of what's even possible. It's possible she could turn it around tomorrow, but if it's particularly stubborn, it might be there a long time, even if she wants to change it.
Sure.
So sometimes we just have to accept that we all have our issues.
And what do you think about advice? I've always had a queasy, like, feeling about advice and not giving it, because it's like an artificial seed to me. But I think a lot of people could benefit from it in a very stuck gray area.
Absolutely. Advice has a bad reputation, and I think, I don't know where that came from. If I was doing something wrong and someone gave me advice and it was great and I was open to it, I'd love it. Mm-hmm. If you see I'm doing something wrong, by all, don't wait for me to Socratically come upon the answer. Like, just tell me what to do. Having said that, the reason why advice got a bad reputation is because it would be forced on people.
Right.
And it would have a judgment and a criticism in there.
Right.
You should be doing this. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with you? Now, if it's that, then obviously that doesn't usually go over very well.
Right.
But if it's compassionately delivered, or if the person's, and or if the person's open to hearing something, then by all means, you know, offer. You're not telling them they're a terrible person. You're not telling them that they're stupid. You're not saying this is the only way. You're not telling them you know 100% of everything and they know nothing. You're just saying, you know what, here, I'm just going to throw it out there.
Just a suggestion.
Yeah. How about this? You know, maybe this will work. There's nothing wrong with that.
Because then they have more choice around accepting that, I guess.
Yeah. Any last questions, Monica?
I think that's it.
Any final reflections on our talk here?
Man, I'm just really grateful to have met you. And this has really been pretty awesome for me. And I'm excited to keep going and looking into bringing compassionate communication into therapy and see where that takes me, because it's a pretty important part of my life, and to be able to share that with other people too is really pretty important to me. Because I've seen the benefit in my family and other families, and I want to be able to spread that as wide as possible. And I'm just one kid, so you know, how much can I actually do? But I'm gonna take it where I can.
Well, I think you could be a therapist now because of all the education your mom has given you around maturity and awareness and how to communicate. I would also consider, if I was in your shoes, how you can fold in your homeschooling experience and how you might be able to propagate that model of homeschooling. Mm-hmm. And maybe it already is a model that's being propagated. I don't know. But if you could somehow help other families with their homeschooling, or even promote homeschooling for certain families, and tell and show them, look, there's a very well-rounded, robust model that you can have that will address any of the concerns you have about homeschooling, because it sounds like you had a lot of socializing growing up.
Yeah.
Which is one of the main criticisms of homeschooling. Yeah, and that's the stereotype. You have this like pasty kid who never leaves the house and doesn't know how to communicate with anybody. But but that to me has always been ridiculous, because again, prior to, I don't know, a couple hundred years ago, like everyone just grew up in their villages and they didn't have big public schools, and somehow they socialized, you know? And so there's that. How did you discover the podcast? I'm curious.
I looked up psychology on like the Apple podcast app, and yours was one of the first ones that came up, and I was like, psychology and Seattle, two things that I love a lot. So downloaded it and was like, oh my gosh, how cool is this? So yeah, and I think that was a couple months ago, and I adore podcasts of all kinds, and this one was just like, this really resonates with me. So yeah, I was excited to contact you and be able to meet you in person, too.
Cool.
It's been quite a trip.
Well, thanks for joining us out there for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. Thanks for joining me, Monica.
Thank you.